I just sent off word to Tim, who's working the Coast to Coast website, that I wasn't going to have a blog for tonight. And then I remembered something that I had snagged earlier from having cleared several hundred messages that you all have been sending in. And so I did have a link I wanted to put up. So, Tim, if you're listening, I take that all back. And, in fact, I'm sending you a blog here in about 10 minutes that'll have a link up that I'd love to have you take a look at. We'll do just a couple of quick crypto news stories coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. And last night, if you were listening to Coast AM, you heard Harry Shearer in the first hour, and then on with Dr. Bart D. Ehrman, the author of Jesus Interrupted. Gosh, I liked last night's show. I thought it was I thought it was informative. I thought most of the questions at the end of the show were insightful and very interesting. Couldn't get everybody on that we wanted to. We probably could have done another 2 hours worth of questions and comments. And so that just means that next time Dr. Ehrman's got a book out, I know he's going to come back and we'll continue the conversation about the contradictions that exist in the biblical texts, both in what Christians call the Old Testament and the New Testament, and then some of the contradictions in the biblical story of Jesus itself. Not that it invalidates, it doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just, in some cases, a lot of these inaccuracies, as we can look at them, if we dare, are sometimes hard for some people to handle, and therefore, when they're translating Bibles into English, they tend to take them out, tend to smooth over them. But if you go back to the original languages, they're right there. In any event, if you didn't catch last night's show, I recommend you go back and listen to it in Streamlink. Especially that first hour with Harry Shearer, of course, star of The Simpsons and Spinal Tap and many other projects, and it was fun. I enjoyed my email conversations with him, too, after last night's show. And one of these nights, I'm going to get him to stick around and do a whole 3 hours. I don't know about what yet, but it's always entertaining. Same thing with Joseph P. Farrell. The research that he has done over the years on hidden technologies of World War II is enough to fill several books, and he has, and he's got another one out on Roswell and the Reich, the connection, the Nazi connection between the story of the landing of the crash landing of a UFO at Roswell and the Third Reich. How could that be? 2 years separate the end of World War II, the formal end of the Third Reich, and the crash at Roswell. But if you go back and look at the original research, which Joseph Farrell has done, the connection is made for us. And we'll talk about that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, if you go online tonight at coasttocoastam.com, take a look at some of the cool stories that are up there, including the hot story about how dog growls contain specific information. This follows along the lines of the research that people have been doing on babies cooing. That is surprisingly more nuanced than anybody had originally thought. Dog growls may all sound the same to human ears, but they hold more specific meanings for dog listeners. Once you know what to listen for, there's also some great listeners email about Bigfoot carvings. This goes back to a topic we had a couple of weeks ago on Coast to Coast. And the feature story online is about an ongoing sighting of UFOs over Euclid, Ohio. And you can go find out more at coasttocoastam.com. Well, and as long as we're talking about that, let's also raise awareness about the link that'll be up, the blog from last night, which is still up from coasttocoastam.com, and an addition for tonight. Thank you to the founder of the Ian Punnett is DB Cooper Facebook page. I'd mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, but I didn't have the link for it, but we're putting it up on the webpage tonight. I believe it's conclusive proof that I am D.B. Cooper. No wonder I've been obsessed about trying to find who is D.B. Cooper. It really is just a search for the self. And I can't believe my mother let me do that. My God, I was only 11, Mom. What were you thinking? Joseph P. Farrell is a regular guest on Coast to Coast, and I always enjoy talking with him. He's a Sodak boy. Joseph, how are you tonight?
Pretty good, Ian. Thanks for having me back on.
Oh, you know what? I can't get enough of you, and I can't get enough of this book. it's so interesting to me. Now, we've talked before about the alternative theories about World War II history, about right. your research into Nazi technologies in the past.
Right.
And it seems like your work has been building up to this book, Roswell and the Reich. This is kind of where it all seems to come together.
Yeah, and I was kind of driving toward this book way back with SS Brotherhood of the Bell, but you're right, Ian. This is the book I've been driving to, because this book really kind of brings it up to date. It brings it up to the contemporary period, and you know, I'm planning on some special projects with Mr. Hoagland to kind of follow up on this one. So, yeah, this book ties it all together.
Okay. Now, you are still a professor, or you were an adjunct professor? Help me out with a little bit more of your background for people that don't know you.
Yeah, I was an adjunct professor for many years, from about 1991, I'd say, up until about 1998-99. I did have an administrative post for 1 year as well, full-time post with the University of Oklahoma, doing interdisciplinary seminars and studies that were kind of team-taught affairs. But yes, I've been in the academic arena.
Right, including work in Oxford?
Oh, yes, that's where, yeah, a friend of mine and I call that the old fiend, and that's where I did my PhD work, yes.
At Oxford?
At Oxford, yes, sir.
Not Oxnard, at
no.
Oxford.
No, not Oxnard. No.
Okay, I just want to make that clear, because I don't think people give you enough credit for that's a great pedigree, and no wonder you put so much effort into the research. Everything about what you write is heavily footnoted. In the end, I love the sort of peer reviewable attitude that you bring to your work. You're open to discussion on this,
sure.
But you do you cross all your T's and you dot all your I's, and that says a lot to me about this. You're not just talking off the top of your head. You dig deep on this stuff.
Well, I try, Ian, and you're right. I do reference things rather heavily, because I realize when you're dealing with material of this nature, especially Roswell, I mean, come on, we have zillions of books out there, so you can't really talk about Roswell unless you research what other people have dug up and what they've put about. And so, yeah, I try and reference things rather heavily, because I do argue in all of my books speculative cases, but the point that I try to make with them is that they are argued cases. I'm not just inventing this, you know. I'm arguing that if you look at facts a certain way, then yes, you can come to these conclusions. So, yeah, I do reference things rather heavily.
Now, have you ever heard back from, you know, anybody at Oxford? Do they ever send you like an email and say, Joseph, Roswell, really?
No, I haven't heard anything from anybody that I knew at Oxford, but okay. I do have some contacts that are quite familiar with the place. So.
I bet. Well, you know, I want to unpack your book a little bit different.
Sure.
for the radio tonight. So thank you for going with me on this, because you stack it a little bit differently, but you also make some different assumptions of the reader that I can't make of the listener. So let's back up a little bit and
sure.
say, explain for the purposes of people who know nothing at all about kind of this sort of crypto technology
right.
of the Third Reich,
right.
what it is that you and many others believe the Nazis were working on, let's say, in the latter half of World War II.
Well, to be giving you the Cliff Notes version, I think what they were working on, Ian, was a technology that was a gateway technology. My research has been focused on a project called the Nazi Bell. And this project was essentially a gateway technology that I believe they were designing to lead them to three things simultaneously. The first was that they were working on this technology to allow them access to free energy, or so-called zero-point energy. And the reason for this was they essentially wanted to free Germany from dependence on petroleum resources, which, of course, Germany did not have any of. And during the war, of course, they had to make synthetic oil and synthetic gasoline just to keep their war machine running. The second purpose that they were researching this technology for, and this, of course, is the relevance to Roswell, is that they were researching this for a true field propulsion type of technology that would be, decades in advance of anything that anybody really was working on at the time. The third thing that they were doing in was they were attempting to weaponize this technology. And let me explain the physics basis of what this technology was. It essentially was a technology that was designed to tap into the fabric of space-time itself. So in other words, if you can engineer the fabric of space-time locally, then you do have a technology that will give you access to these three things, a free energy and a field propulsion device, but as a weapon. Of course, anytime you weaponize this stuff, potentially, you have a weapon that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. So they were doing truly, truly exotic avant-garde research.
The as you said, it's sort of a three-pronged thing. If they get one, they get all three in a way. That if they can, and the belief is that there's some physical evidence that they had even constructed what might be, by some people's estimation, a kind of launching pad for some type of new craft. Talk about that.
Well, there is the place where all of this technology was tested is a little town in Germany. At the time, it was known as Ludwigsdorf, but now, of course, it's part of Poland, and the Polish name is Ludwikowice. But there is a structure there that looks rather like Stonehenge. It looks like a very modern version of a hinge. It's made out of concrete. It's about, 40 to 45 feet wide, about 30 feet tall. It sits in kind of a basin or a pool. There are some people that have argued, I think quite erroneously, that this was a cooling tower for an electrical power plant. But the problem, Ian, and I want to bring this point to those people arguing this way, that there does exist an Allied photo reconnaissance photo from the end of the war where there is absolutely no cooling tower present and never was. So this structure was used to test this Bell device. And the important point here, Ian, is to note that this device was apparently seen by some of the concentration camp victims in the nearby camp of Gross Rosen during the night, rising above the tree line, glowing a kind of a pale blue glow, which to me signifies the use of plasma and very high voltage electricity in this device. But then this device would settle back down below the tree line, and apparently this hinge was probably the structure that was used to test the device outdoors. So, yes, this is quite a story. And I want to add one more thing to kind of make it relevant to today. At the end of the war, as the Nazis are kind of driving the technological division of the spoils, what they did, Ian, was they, in my opinion, created more or less a stalemate in the division of the spoils between the United States and the Soviet bloc. But this project, according to my research, I believe went to Argentina and remained in independent Nazi hands after the war. And that's the key link here to Roswell.
Okay, we'll get back to that. Because I think that what you're getting at is what a lot of people would have assumed,
right?
Since there was, Operation Paperclip afoot to get as many of the Nazi rocket scientists into U.S. control to keep them out of the hands of the Soviets. By and large, the Nazi rocket club there wanted to go to the United States. They didn't want to go to the Soviet Union.
Right.
They saw that they had a marketable skill that they, in many cases, felt they weren't real Nazis anyway. They were scientists who merely were forced to toil under the jackboot of Hitler, and therefore it was easier for them to make a new life for themselves and their family in the United States than kind of the reparations that they would have to make in the Soviet Union, where they would be forced almost at sort of like at gunpoint to be rocket scientists for the Soviet Union or to be able to live free in the U.S.
Right.
So but the, so the thought has always been that it was sort of like two for us, one for you, you know, one for us, one for you, was we kind of dividing this up toward the end. But you make the argument that some, at least some of them, escaped to Argentina. Who, at the end of the war, who is unaccounted for?
Well, there's a whole lot of people, and two figures in particular are going to be very crucial in our discussion tonight. One of them is a scientist by the name of Dr. Ronald Richter, who is, in my opinion, the scientist that continued this Bell project in Argentina, more or less under the ostensible oversight, you might say, of Juan Perón and his government. But it's very obvious to me that Perón is really not the one in charge of this project. There's somebody else. The other character that we need to pay very close attention to down in Argentina is Reimar Horton, who was, of course, the designer of the Horton brothers' team of the famous German flying wing designs. He made it to Argentina after the war, and in fact, he was involved in the design and building of very, very advanced aircraft for Juan Perón in Argentina. I even have a picture of one of these things in the book. It's a Delta wing jet aircraft, very advanced looking.
Years before we had them in the at the level that the Nazis were developing. They had the edge on this, and then at the same time too, even you see those Delta wings. And that brings us back to what a lot of people say they saw over Phoenix in the famous Phoenix light.
Yes,
I mean, that was a Delta wing kind of craft that was moving very slowly.
Yes, exactly. He's one of the key figures here, Ian, because he's mentioned in one of the crucial documents that forms a central component of the arguments of, I'll call them the extraterrestrial proponents within Roswell research. He is mentioned in one of the documents that they themselves cite as evidence for the extraterrestrial nature of Roswell. But, as I point out in Roswell and the Reich, the version of the document that they're citing is a fake version. The original version does not mention extraterrestrials at all. The only concern in that original version of this document is that this technology the U.S. Air Force has concluded is something that comes ultimately from the Third Reich. And when you say that, the mask is off, because this means that the Air Force is really concerned that there is some continuation of Nazism out there, if you read the document carefully enough. And if that's the case, then where's this technology coming from? And where is Reimar Horton? You know, the document even mentions him by name in that exact context.
Yeah, so. And that's a great teaser for where we're going to end up, because why would any of these names come up after the crash of Roswell? We're talking years after the end of World War II. So why even talk about that? How could that even be relevant? So all right, so World War II comes to an end. Everybody for themselves. Some people grab a sub or a ship and get to Argentina. Other people are willingly walking up with their hands up in the air saying, please take me, to the U.S., and others are being taken away to the Soviet Union. And we think it's over. We've got as many of the rocket scientists as we could possibly find. We begin the rehabilitation program to try to turn them into Americans and to get the technology they've been working on. But that going back to that piece, nobody is talking about that. The possibility that they had come up with this alternative form of energy. We're not hearing it doesn't appear in the historical record.
Right.
We're left to try to put that together in the rearview mirror of history. So what we do know is that there was something going on toward the end of World War II that it had something to do with an alternative energy source that they were also hoping to weaponize. And to give them the sort of the Hail Mary pass, if you pardon the term, for them to try to win the war.
Right.
And that's just where we leave it. Now, Hang on, Joseph. Then we'll talk. Then let's skip ahead and let's talk about the events of Roswell.
Sure.
Prior to all of the other modern research, let's strip away all of the other research that's come. Let's go back to that day, and then the series of reports that came up immediately following the original Roswell incident. Okay. And then we'll start putting it all back together again. Joseph P. Farrell is the author of Roswell in the Reich. Does this sound crazy to think that there's a Nazi connection in the crash at Roswell? Joseph P. Farrell has a PhD from Oxford. What do we know? Nothing. Not till we find out next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I hope you're going to enjoy this ride tonight. I know I am. We'll do several hours yet with Joseph Farrell on the Roswell Reich connection. I've got a couple of energy drinks and some Slim Jims. That's how I'll be going for the next couple of hours. I hope you join us too. Last hour will be open lines, but in the meantime, let's explore the Nazi connection between these two stories, the crash of something flown by somebody at Roswell and the crypto technology of the Third Reich, which we're still beginning to understand. Some of the projects they were working on toward the end of World War II, many of which did not go either to the U.S. or to the USSR, but went to Argentina. And that's just where we'll pick up the story next. And what about those little guys? Didn't they find little green men at Roswell? Lots of testimony about that. Well, let's go back to the original story with Joseph Farrell next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Joseph P. Farrell, author of Roswell and the Reich. I was teasing my friend Harry Shearer last night about his Wikipedia page, and you have a lot of cool stuff on your page, but do you know that you're not listed as notable alumni from your from John Brown University? Well, and you should be. That's where you went to undergrad, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, you should be. That is an oversight. You know, I've never heard of any of the other people that they put up there as notable alumni. You should be on the list. I remember John Brown University made the news a couple of, that's in Arkansas, right?
That's right. Silent Springs, Arkansas.
I remember when it made news a couple of years ago when they were trying to update their image. It's a conservative liberal arts college. By having a swing dance.
Well, that's about right.
they were letting their hair down a little bit. They're having a swing dance. I love that. God bless them for that. All right, so let's get back to let's talk about Roswell itself. The real story of Roswell, and I say the real story meaning the original story of Roswell. There's lots of different ways that the Roswell story can be told.
Right.
But let's just go back to what. Kind of like the baseline of which there is little dispute. And this is based on the original newspaper accounts,
right,
and the original testimony.
Right. Well, the original story, Ian, to me, is where the story gets fascinating right off the bat, because the story is that a rancher, his name is Mac Brizzle, found a bunch of debris, very peculiar debris, on his ranch, sheep ranch, about 75 miles northwest of Roswell. He boxed up a bunch of this debris, took it into town, and showed it to the sheriff, who really wasn't that interested, but said he should contact the local airbase. At that time, Roswell was home to the 509th Bomb Group, which, of course, was the only atomic bomb group in the world at the time. So the base commander, a fellow by the name of Colonel William Blanchard, his nickname was Butch, he sent his base intelligence officer, Major Jesse Marcel Sr., out to this ranch along with the base's counterintelligence officer, Sheridan Cavett, to look at this debris on this ranch. And Marcel, of course, is now kind of the central character in the Roswell story, because he later, much later in life, was contacted by the researchers Stanton Friedman and Bill Moore, who interviewed him, and he described this very strange debris as being kind of a light foil-like material that you could crumple up and it would unbend You could blow through this stuff. It had very strange kind of hieroglyphic-looking characters on it. It had numbers and so on and so forth. Well, that's the beginning of the Roswell story, because the local airbase there put out a press release by Lieutenant Walter Hout, who was the base press officer, and the Roswell Daily Record ran this story based on this press release. And the story was that the U.S. Air Force had recovered a flying saucer. And end of story.
Right.
That was the original story. And mere hours later, of course, Major Marcel, the intelligence officer, was ordered to report to the headquarters of the 8th Army, U.S. Army Air Force in Fort Worth, Texas. So he flies to Fort Worth, Texas with this debris. And then, of course, there, the U.S. Air Force changes the story, Ian, within mere hours after releasing the flying saucer press release. And this time they come out and say, oh, it was just a case of mistaken identity of a flying saucer. What we really recovered was just a weather balloon. Now, to me, Ian, this sets up what I call the Roswell dialectic, because every version of the Roswell story that researchers have told since then, be they ET proponent or skeptic, has been locked into an explanation or a defense, either of we recovered a crashed extraterrestrial craft, or it was just a balloon of some sort.
Right. Right.
There's no in between with this story. And that is what really has fascinated with me all along, because we're being asked to believe, in the case of the balloon story, that the senior intelligence officer of the only atomic bomb group in the world at the time can't tell the difference between a weather balloon and a flying saucer, you know.
Right. Because one of the qualifications of becoming the head of that program was to be an idiot. And so they
Yes, of course, yeah.
Right. So they but let's talk about the beings, the story that what was the original testimony about any human-like beings that were found at the crash site?
Okay, well, that's problem number one, Ian, because in the original first layer of the story, there isn't any testimony about the recovery of bodies. There's no mention of bodies whatsoever. This is a point that emerges much later. In fact, it begins to come out when the Roswell story begins to be researched by Charles Berlitz and Bill Moore, and then, of course, Stanton Friedman and Don Berliner.
Right.
This is where we have the bodies, and I'm not saying that they're added to the story, but they simply emerge at a much later point in the story, okay? Now, the interesting thing, Ian, is, and I try to do this very, very carefully in the book, the interesting thing to me is that the witnesses who have maintained that they saw bodies are, by and large, number one, for the most part, they are witnesses who testify secondhand based on somebody's explanations or stories that were told to them before they died.
Okay? If, for example, my dad told me later on what he wouldn't tell the press, that there was, you know, there were bodies there.
Exactly.
That my dad said this later on, and right. Or I found
exactly.
This in his writings or whatever. Right.
Exactly. Now, this is problem number one with the story, because, of course, in any court of law, at least in American jurisprudence, that sort of testimony would not be admitted. So this is the first problem. But the second problem to me is even more interesting. Let's assume for the sake of argument that these witnesses who describe bodies did in fact see bodies, or they relayed their stories accurately and faithfully to those who eventually reported them. The problem here, Ian, as I see it, is the bodies that are being described are almost uniformly said to be between about 4 to 5 feet tall. They have disproportionately large heads, and so on and so forth. And the problem is that in most cases, in all but two cases, in fact, we are treated to a description of bodies that do not compel to any extraterrestrial origin for them. The only two exceptions are the case of Sergeant Melvin Brown, who described bodies with kind of an orange-yellow, beady, lizard-like skin. But the person that tells his story, namely his daughter, has changed her story so many times that it throws the whole testimony into suspicion. The other person that described bodies of a very peculiar nature was, of course, the famous mortician Glenn Dennis, who referred to the testimony of a nurse friend of his that described these bodies to him. Unfortunately, he managed to impeach himself as a witness, so his testimony is no longer reliable.
Yeah, explain that.
Well, in his case, he maintained that his nurse friend, he did not recall her name, and then he changed the name to Roswell researchers. In other words, what he did, in effect, was he lied to the very researchers that were trying to uncover this story. So his testimony is no longer admitted, even by many of the mainstream Roswell researchers. He's an impeached witness. So what the thing that we're left with, Ian, at this point, then, is if you leave out these two witnesses that describe such unusual physiological features, and they're both inconsistent with each other, and they're both inconsistent with the other witnesses who describe bodies. So what we're left with is that main group of witnesses who are describing simply small bodies. In their words, they often say they look like children about 10 to 12 years old.
Right.
They have very large eyes, you know, other strange features. But there is in that list of features nothing that compels to the fact that these were extraterrestrial beings. We simply have very odd-looking humans. That's what we're dealing with.
By the way, I too once had a very good nurse friend, and I'm not saying how good a friend. I'm just saying I would have been kicked out of John Brown University. So I'm willing to attest to. It would impeach any testimony I give. But this is the part I think that was really interesting that I'd never heard before until I read the book. Again, we're talking with Dr. Joseph Farrell and the Roswell Reich book, The Nazi Connection, between these two very seemingly disconnected events in history, the end of World War II and the recovery of Nazi technology and the crash of something in Roswell in 1947, a couple of years later, that when they found, according to some people, and you'll remember this better than I will, but I remember in your book that they were attempting to speak in German,
yes,
or Japanese or Spanish to these beings,
yes,
on the ground. What's with talking in German or Spanish?
Well, again, you know, this particular story is to me the whole problem with Roswell, as the standard pro extraterrestrial interpretation of it would have us believe. Because first of all, the witness saying these things, you know, maintaining that they were trying to communicate with these beings that they discovered outside, you know, kind of littering the ground outside this crashed craft. Well, this witness is one of those witnesses whose testimony has now been rejected by the very Roswell researchers who dug him up in the first place, okay?
Right.
So if we assume then, just for the sake of argument, that the testimony is to be admitted, let's go back to circa 1993, 1994, in the evolution of the Roswell mythology, okay?
Okay.
When that witness was first produced, it didn't occur to the researchers to ask why, in the name of sense, are they trying to talk to these supposedly extraterrestrial creatures in Spanish, Japanese, and German.
Right.
Exactly. So, in other words, all the clues, even by some of the impeached witnesses, point again in a completely terrestrial direction. And this is the problem with the story, as far as I'm concerned. Because we're clearly dealing with something that the military wants covered up, obviously, because the balloon story, pardon my pun here, just isn't going to float.
Right.
But the problem with the extraterrestrial story is, number one, we, at the first layer of the story, we don't have any mention of bodies whatsoever. What we really have is a story about some very unusual debris. So if we rationalize the bodies as being terrestrial, then the real problem with Roswell is the debris and where does it come from. And if we, again, go back to that document that I mentioned in the first half hour of the show, the document itself cited by those Roswell researchers makes it very clear that the concern of U.S. Air Force intelligence is that this ultimately comes from the Third Reich.
So, again, I'm gonna make you hang that out for just a few more minutes before
sure.
we get back to it, because I want to amplify that the on the first level of research we have no mention at all of bodies.
Right.
In the second level, there are mentions of bodies
sure.
at the Roswell crash, but they appear to be terrestrial bodies because the people who are there are trying to speak to them in terrestrial languages,
right?
And the languages of our former enemies during World War II.
Yeah.
So, which is really interesting. That
yeah, it is.
Again, if these were to use the explanation later on by the Air Force that what were perceived as extraterrestrials, which they're willing to cop to, were really just test dummies
yes.
that went up with this weather balloon. If that were true, then you'd have soldiers that were no smarter than somebody who couldn't tell the difference between a living human being and a test dummy, and they're trying to talk German to a dead dummy.
Or an extraterrestrial. Exactly.
Or an extraterrestrial. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Of course not. Of course not.
But
that's the whole problem here, and you've put your finger right on it.
So when we peel it back, just let's dial it back a little bit to what we know, that in 1947 something landed, and that there were everybody from the very beginning stipulated that there were symbols on some of the, there was language markings
right.
on some of this debris. Now, talk about why they thought that it might be Japanese.
Well, that's very easy, because one of the things that Major Marcel says in his first interviews is that the characters that he saw looked rather like Chinese or Japanese writing. And that was a description that was repeated by the son of the rancher that actually discovered the debris. His name was Bill Brazel, okay? And Bill said the same thing, that some of this writing that his father described to him looked rather like Chinese or Japanese characters with a lot of, and here's another clue for you, Ian, with a lot of numbers, okay? So my second problem with the descriptions of the debris is that the witnesses describing it mentioned these numbers. Well, how do you recognize numbers? They've either got to be Arabic numerals or they've got to be Roman numerals.
Right.
You know, E.T. is probably not going to be using the same symbolic system of numerology.
Exactly.
So,
but it wouldn't be uncommon for somebody who was Asian, say an Asian scientist,
exactly.
to use Western style numbers.
Exactly. So again, we have another clue that from the debris itself that bespeaks of a terrestrial origin for it. And what I believe has happened, Ian, is that to a certain extent, I'm willing to entertain the idea that the extraterrestrial component was added to the story or spun into the story by the Air Force at the outset with that initial flying saucer recovery story, precisely in order to prevent people from looking too closely and in too much detail at the descriptions of the debris.
Okay, but I don't think, I mean, I remember reading that part. I don't even think, if I could be critical, I don't even think you need to do that.
Oh, I would agree.
Yeah, I think what you have here are people who are processing in real time,
right.
whose real thoughts are coming out along a natural human timeline where
right.
they're associating the unfamiliar with some known fact that already exists in their mind. I mean, they're trying to make sense of the nonsensical. So if you've got some craft that has crashed, mm-hmm. you're looking for these touchstones into things that you already can understand, so that we kind of bring, if you'll pardon it, they're attempting to bring intellectual order to intellectual chaos.
Exactly. I couldn't agree with you more. That's precisely the point.
So they don't even have to be thinking of a cover story. They're just saying, well, this, it was, and in a way, it was extraterrestrial, at least in the sense that they knew it wasn't from us. They knew it wasn't from the United States.
Exactly.
And that's all that they knew. But they did, and this is what we also have as part of the record, they did think that it could have come from the Third Reich.
Right. That's right.
Now, why would they think that this craft could have come from a government that had been vanquished 2 years prior? That's where we'll pick it up, coming up at the top of the hour. And that will bring us back to missing documents, missing scientists, missing technology that all ended up in Argentina. It may also explain why somebody was trying to speak Spanish to these dead beings on the ground. And this is how we'll start to make the Roswell-Reich connection, the Nazi connection that's in Joseph P. Farrell's latest book. You can link up to him through our webpage at coasttocoastam.com. This is Ian Punnett.